Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. Over the last two episodes, we've talked at great length about the various disasters that befell the Roman Empire over the course of the calamitous 5th century. Powerful generals and court officials dominated the children and incompetent adults who occupied the imperial office until the death of Valentinian III in 455. By the time vigorous and accomplished leaders became emperors once again, men like Majorian and Anthemius, the structures and institutions that had acted as the foundation of the Roman political system were too far gone to be recovered. It was only a matter of time after that before the imperial center collapsed completely. When Romulus Augustulus was deposed in 476, the last vestiges of the Western Empire disappeared, not with a bang, but with a whimper. What replaced the political structures of the Roman Empire over the course of the 5th century, province by province and region by region, until finally Italy itself slipped the moorings of the state, were the barbarian kingdoms. They're sometimes called the successor kingdoms, if you prefer that term. They popped up all over the Western Empire between 418 and 489, from Hadrian's Wall to Carthage, and by various means. Each of these kingdoms came into being in its own way, and each developed more or less along its own lines, influenced by the circumstances of settlement, the local context, subsequent developments, and random chance. Each built upon the social, cultural, economic, and political legacy of the Roman Empire in its own unique ways. Some of them were planted by violent force, like those of the Vandals and the Sueves. Others stepped into a power vacuum, like those of the Franks in northern Gaul, and eventually the Anglo-Saxons in Britain. Still others were settled by treaty with the imperial authorities, like the Burgundians and the Visigoths. It's on the Visigoths that we'll focus in today's episode. Their kingdom, planted around the city of Toulouse in southwest Gaul, was the first of these successor states to come into being, and it laid the blueprint for the many others that would follow. The Goths' struggle for increasing independence as a separate power bloc within the empire over the course of the 5th century was both a reflection of, and a contributing factor to, the structural rot and subsequent weakening of the empire as a whole. Being first had its advantages, and the Visigoths exploited those edges to the fullest in their long, slow climb from settled army to one of the dominant forces occupying the ruins of the Western Empire. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. We've already covered the prehistory of this Visigothic kingdom at some length in the second, third, and fourth episodes of this show. So if you like, you might go back and refresh yourself on the story of our friend Volfila and his compatriots. To recap, the roots of this Visigothic kingdom are to be found among the descendants of the Goths who fled from the Huns across the Danube in 376, who defeated the Roman army at the Battle of Adrianople in 378, and who were eventually settled in the Balkans in 382. These Goths, or at least some of them, along with those claiming that label and identity, were the core of the general Alaric's forces when he rebelled in 395 and ran roughshod through both the Western and the Eastern empires for the next 15 years, sacking the city of Rome itself in 410. That's a bit of an oversimplification, though. This was a complicated situation that doesn't really boil down to anything as straightforward as Goths versus Romans. Alaric and his Goths were effectively a mobile army, operating on their own at a time when especially the Western Empire was desperately in need of troops, and this gave them a tremendous negotiating position from which to work. Sometimes, they fought against the imperial authorities, as they did in a series of battles against the Generalissimo Stilicho. Sometimes, they worked for the imperial authorities, as they did in two separate periods of settlement where they were functioning as a garrison in Illyricum and Pannonia. Sometimes, they were looking to negotiate, but they were effectively driven to use force because that was the only option left to them, as was the case when they sacked Rome. Threatening the Eternal City was a negotiating tactic that had worked before, and when the Emperor Honorius's government refused to parley with them, the only choice left was taking and plundering the city. Following the sack of Rome and the death of Alaric shortly thereafter, the Goths headed for Gaul under the leadership of Athaulf, Alaric's brother-in-law. Once there, they played both for and then against an imperial usurper, tried and failed to make a go of it on their own, and eventually went to work for the imperial government, fighting against the Vandals, Alans, and Suaves in Iberia. They were crushingly successful, and in 418, the Goths were settled in Aquitaine around the city of Toulouse in recognition of their past work and in payment for future military service. This was the origin of the Visigothic kingdom. Why Visigothic and not just Gothic? Well, because the Visigoths weren't the only Goths. There were still plenty of Goths living beyond the Danube under the rule of the Huns in the territory from which the Goths of 376 had fled. There were plenty of Goths serving in the Eastern Roman army, presumably a mixture of recruits drawn from the Goths settled in 382 who hadn't gone with Alaric when he rebelled, along with new arrivals from beyond the Danube. A later group of Goths would enter the Roman Empire after the fall of Attila's empire and establish a kingdom for themselves in Italy. They've become known as the Ostrogoths. For the most part in this episode, though, I'll refer to these Visigoths and Goths interchangeably. Long story short, this is a confusing tapestry of Goths, and Visigoths is a handy term for them, if not necessarily the one they would have used for themselves. Before we move on to the kingdom itself, I want to say a few words about those Goths who settled in Aquitaine in 418. It's a mistake to draw, as I've done here, a direct line from those Goths of 376 to those who came to reside in Aquitaine 42 years later. Well, it's not a mistake exactly, but it is a little bit misleading. Why? Because it implies a continuity of membership in the body that we're calling, quote-unquote, the Goths, and a continuity of meaning of that label, the Goths, that doesn't really fit with the reality of the situation. So let's break this down a little bit. Now, to be clear, what I'm presenting here is my version of this story. That's the one I find the most convincing. It would be misleading for me to say that this represents the scholarly consensus, because frankly, there isn't one on these questions of ethnic identity, group membership, and continuity. Some historians would draw that direct line from 376 to 418. Some would happily emphasize a version of Gothicness focused on immigration and descent from beyond the Danube. Some would focus on the perceived ethnic differences between barbarians and Romans. Some would rather call them a people on the move rather than just an army. I don't find those perspectives to be particularly convincing for reasons that are mostly technical and not that interesting, but if you want me to go deeper on that front, just hit me up. Just be aware as you're listening to this that there are alternative ways to tell this story. So, anyway, here's my version. After the initial group of Goths crossed the Danube in 376, they were joined by other Goths and even Huns in the lead-up to the Battle of Adrianople. Afterward, as they were raiding and fighting their way through Thrace and the Balkans, they picked up various escaped slaves and other folks who probably didn't identify as Goths. In 382, this entire group, newcomers and all, was settled in the Balkans. When Alaric rebelled in 395, he did so as the leader of a unit of the Roman army. Some of these soldiers were presumably Goths, most likely ones drawn from the group settled by the Treaty of 382, but there's no reason to think that all of them were. After the initial rebellion, Alaric was joined by some of those settlers of 382. Remember, not all of them Goths drawn from beyond the Danube, but the process of addition and subtraction didn't stop there. Escaped slaves joined them throughout their journey, and so did survivors of the army of the Gothic king Radagaisus who tried and failed to invade Italy in 405. Some of them were Goths, and some of them definitely weren't. They were joined by members of the army of Stilicho after his assassination, who were presumably drawn from a variety of different ethnic groups. Presumably some Goths, but definitely others who weren't. Now this was, first and foremost, an army, and in terms of the ethnic diversity of its makeup, it wasn't really much different than any other Roman army of this period. The Roman army as a whole was largely composed of people of barbarian descent, and as we discussed at length in the episode on the army, being a soldier and being a barbarian were closely linked in the minds of both the soldiers themselves and the Roman authors who wrote about them. Telling the difference between a Roman soldier who wore trousers, spoke a dialect of Latin heavily spiced with Germanic words, had tattoos and scars, and who lived apart from civilian society, from a barbarian Goth, that distinction wouldn't have been easy to make. In fact, I'd argue that confusion is precisely the point here. The Roman military was barbarized, and the barbarians were militarized. To understand the Goths and their settlement in Aquitaine in 418, we have to understand them in this context, as an army on the move with families and children, just like any other army in this period. Over the course of its long journey, 23 years since Alaric's rebellion began, this army had started to call itself and see itself as the Goths. This was a long process of war, privation, hardship, death, and growth that welded these recruits drawn from various sources and backgrounds into something like an ethnic group. The generals of this army that became an ethnic group weren't just generals anymore, but kings, though what it meant to be a king of the Goths at this point isn't easy to say. This is why it's misleading to draw a straight line from the Danube in 376 to Toulouse in 418. It papers over this entire process of ethnic becoming. These weren't the same people, and I mean that literally. A 30-year-old adult who crossed the Danube in 376 would have been 72 years old at the time of the settlement in Toulouse. Most of those who were drawn in one way or another from the Goths of 376 would have been children at the time of the Danube crossing, or, more likely, born inside the Roman Empire. The older generation, the ones who'd been adults when they fled the Huns, fought at Adrianople, and starved in the Balkans prior to the settlement of 382, were either elderly or, more likely, long dead. This is the key to understanding the Visigoths and what would become a coherent polity. This kingdom belongs in the context of the Roman Empire, constructed by people who were largely first or even second generation immigrants, and who grew up familiar with the empire and its ways of doing things. Not a single one of the successor kingdoms was built by an initial wave of barbarian migrants. It was their children, the ones who understood on an innate level how the Roman system worked and what it had to offer, who were best positioned to work within it, exploit it, undermine it, or outright attack it. So this is who the Visigoths were on the eve of their settlement in Toulouse, an army that had become an ethnic group and acquired a king over the course of 40 years of living and operating inside the Roman Empire, mostly in the broad context of the Roman army as an institution. This is something that has to be emphasized. The Visigothic kingdom didn't come into being fully formed. It wasn't even intended to be a kingdom at the beginning, just a settlement of an army that was supposed to stay allied to the Romans and happened to have a leader that they called a king. That process of becoming didn't stop when the Visigoths were settled. Over the course of the next 90 years, their settlement became something much different. This is what I want to focus on here today, this process of becoming a kingdom, of forging a new political unit on the structural foundations provided by the Roman Empire. There would be others after, but the Visigoths were the first. For the rest of today's episode, we're going to do two different things. First, we're going to trace the history, mostly the political history, of this new Visigothic kingdom from its foundation in 418 to its destruction in 507. There's a note on this. The Visigothic kingdom didn't disappear after its crushing defeat at the hands of the Frankish king Clovis in 507. It simply moved to Spain, where it would remain the dominant force for the next two centuries, until the Muslim invasion of the Iberian Peninsula in 711. This Visigothic kingdom in Spain is a topic for another day, though, and it's the Visigothic kingdom of Toulouse on which we'll focus in today's episode. Second, in order to wrap our heads around this process of becoming a kingdom and everything that meant, we'll follow a family of Visigoths from the settlement to the end of the Kingdom of Toulouse. We'll try to understand what it would have meant for real people to be a part of this process of building a kingdom, as they settled, acquired property, had families, fought, died, and were replaced by the next generation. The kingdom of 507 was much, much different than whatever was intended in 418, and it was the dreams, desires, and actions of real people who made that happen. Let's meet a few hypothetical folks who participated in all that, who can humanize these generational shifts within that kingdom.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But let's start with the history of this Visigothic kingdom, beginning with the settlement itself. Nothing about this settlement in 418 points in the direction of a glorious future for Alaric's army-turned-ethnic group as an independent kingdom. Nothing about this suggests a long-term treaty or even an agreement between two equal parties. This was, as far as the evidence can show, a stationing of troops subject to the imperial government. It probably wasn't even meant to be permanent. In 418, that's the traditional date, but some would prefer 419, this wandering Gothic army had no real leverage. They had just inflicted crushing defeats on the Vandals and the Alans in Iberia, but where were they supposed to go now? The only real option was imperial service, not a settlement as equals. They were, for all intents and purposes, a Roman army, and what they were about to receive were billets. How did this go down? Well, there's actually a surprising amount of disagreement about this among historians. This is a deeply technical and confusing series of issues, made much more so by the lack of explicit evidence. I mean, we always struggle with the lack of evidence for this period, but it's shocking just how little there is on the mechanics of how the barbarians were settled in the lands that eventually became their kingdoms. Of all the barbarian settlements, the only one for which we have good, solid contemporary evidence is that of the Ostrogoths in Italy in the late 5th century. For the Visigoths, it's all well after when the settlement took place, and it basically amounts to a few chronicle entries and some fragmentary legal texts. This lack of evidence and the confusion that comes out of it means, naturally, that historians have been arguing about this for literally centuries, and there really isn't a 100% accepted consensus on how the barbarians were settled. I'll give you the version here that I think makes the most sense on the basis of that thin evidence. It's complicated and it's confusing, but it's actually really important because how we view the settlement speaks to how we view both the structures of these new states and the relationships between these new settlers and the people who already lived there. The broad outlines of the model of settlement I'm proposing come from an eminent historian named Walter Goffart, a famously irascible and unpleasant guy. I once saw Goffart criticize a graduate student's presentation at a conference so harshly that he literally made the poor guy cry. So, despite his personal qualities or lack thereof, Goffart is a heck of a historian, and his basic interpretation of barbarian settlement has been the basis of every argument on the topic that's happened in the last 40 years, whether they agreed with him or not. It boils down to this. The Visigoths and the barbarians who were settled after them, not necessarily the Vandals or the Sueves who took provinces by conquest, they didn't necessarily receive land at all when they were settled, but tax shares. This is a brilliant way of interpreting the evidence, one that fits neatly with both the limited texts that we have on the settlements and the broader context of the late Roman state. We don't really hear much in the way of complaining about the barbarians. If there were suddenly thousands of uncouth, foreign-looking soldiers being granted land that presumably had belonged to someone else, you'd expect to hear Roman aristocrats, the kind of people who wrote our sources, yelling from the rooftops about the seizures of land and the indignity of being forced to live next door to a bunch of fur-wearing barbarians. That's not what we hear, though. The late Roman state, as we've discussed at some length, was an intricate fiscal system that had complex and detailed mechanisms for assessing and gathering tax revenues from land. The lion's share of those tax revenues, either in cash or in kind, went to supporting, paying, and supplying the army. If these barbarian settlements were effectively the billeting of an army, why would you go to all the trouble of either giving these soldiers uncultivated wasteland or, alternatively, kicking some rich landowner off of his estate? Why wouldn't you just redirect the tax revenues to pay this new army? What did it matter if they were maybe a little more barbarian than the already barbarous army, that they called themselves the Goths instead of the Gallic Comitatenses, or that they had a king? The Roman state already had perfectly fine fiscal mechanisms in place to deal with situations like this. So this is the basic outline of Goffart's argument. The Visigothic settlement didn't involve kicking anybody off their land to hand estates over to the newcomers. Instead, the Roman state would just redirect the local tax revenues to the Visigoths instead of the central authorities, and the Visigoths would then pay the troops. I think this is basically inarguable as the initial situation of the Visigothic settlement in 418 or 419, but there are still a few holdouts who might disagree with that. Those who still disagree do so not necessarily because handing out tax shares is implausible, but generally because they think the whole overall framework is wrong. For Goffart's basic outline to make sense to you, you have to see the barbarians, as I do, as essentially wandering armies in the Roman tradition with fluid ethnic identities that were then slotted into a still functioning state and tax apparatus without too much in the way of violence and disruption. But if you see the barbarians as a wandering people with a set, distinct ethnic identity who were inclined to take what they wanted by force, it's hard to accept the basic concept that they'd accept tax shares rather than land for settlement. Armies want salaries and take their money peacefully. Peoples want land and they take land violently. That's kind of an oversimplification, but that's the basic dichotomy here. With all of this said, what we're talking about here is the initial settlement. There's no reason that state of affairs had to persist forever, and it's not hard to see how impersonal tax shares might turn into collecting taxes in person and from there to simply appropriating or purchasing the land itself rather than the produce of it. There's good evidence for this from the Theodosian Code, a mid-5th century collection of laws. One text in this collection says that Roman soldiers were assigned to the taxpayers who pay them in cash directly as a draft on taxation. That would seem to fit nicely with the Visigothic evidence, but it still doesn't completely fit with everything we know about it, and this is where Goffart's broad outline runs into some problems. The sources are as clear as possible. The Goths, at least some of them, did receive land. And even soldiers who were paid with drafts on taxation still had to, you know, actually live somewhere. Goffart has been adding to and revising his framework for 35 years, and he's never really come up with satisfactory answers to these counterarguments. The best explanations I've seen are these. Some of the Visigoths, the ones who had been fighting nonstop since 395 or even before, wanted land to settle on, just like any deserving veterans of the Roman army were entitled to, and these long-service retirees would then have received agri deserti, unoccupied land on which to settle. Otherwise, active-duty soldiers would have been billeted wherever there was space for them. That's reasonable enough. But that still doesn't account for some clear later references to the partition of estates when the Visigoths received 2/3 in that division. How do we account for that last piece? We can only do that by understanding the growth and development of the Visigothic kingdom after the settlement. Whatever was intended in 418 or 419, things didn't stay that way. But really quickly, before we move on, why were the Visigoths settled in Aquitaine at all? At first glance, southwestern Gaul feels like an odd location to plant a field army, but in the immediate context of the years around 418, it actually makes pretty good sense. The imperial government had effectively ceded control of Gaul north of the Loire, so Aquitaine was in reality pretty close to the new frontier. There were still Sueves, Vandals, and Alans in Spain, too, and the Goths in Aquitaine would have been right in the middle of them. So, oddly enough, in 418, Aquitaine was no longer a core province separated by hundreds of miles from the ravages of rampaging barbarians. It was kind of right on the front line. It's doubtful that the imperial government thought this state of affairs would last forever. The Visigoths would be billeted in Aquitaine for a while, probably deal with the threats in Iberia, and then take up stations elsewhere. That's not what happened. 5th century politics were chaotic and the central government was weak. Whatever the generalissimo Constantine had intended by settling the Visigoths in 418, it didn't last long. The Visigoths seem to have decided pretty quickly that they weren't content with just being an imperial army. Having a king and an increasingly potent ethnic identity built by 30 years of shared experiences had some consequences, it seems, and as best we can tell, again, the sources are pretty thin on this, the Visigoths acted with a cohesion and a sense of purpose that speaks to the effects of decades of wandering and warfare from the Balkans to Italy to Gaul. When we next hear from the Goths in 421 or 422, they're acting in conjunction with an imperial army in a campaign against the Vandals in Baetica, roughly the south of Spain. On the verge of victory, the Goths apparently failed to aid the imperial army in time. The Vandals defeated the imperial army and the Goths headed home. The new king of the Visigoths, Theodoric, apparently wasn't as interested in working with the imperial authorities as his predecessor Wallia had been. It was under Theodoric's leadership that a real Visigothic kingdom started to emerge from a settled army that happened to have a bunch of Goths in it. The first signs of this increasingly independent bent show up in 426, when the Visigoths first threaten the city of Arles in Provence, the seat of Roman government in Gaul. This was some 200 miles from Toulouse. Whether the Goths were really trying to take Arles, or were more likely trying to strengthen their negotiating position, is kind of immaterial. Roman armies weren't supposed to threaten Roman cities with capture in order to extract concessions. An army of Huns under the great general Aetius drove the Visigoths back to Toulouse, but at that point, a precedent had been set. The Visigoths may have tried for Arles again in 430, though that's unclear, but they definitely tried again between 436 and 439, attacking not just Arles, but also Narbonne at the same time. One of Aetius' generals, a man named Litorius, succeeded in driving them back to their territory around Toulouse, but he couldn't deliver the final blow to bring the Goths to heel. Although apparently victorious in battle, Litorius himself was somehow captured and executed, and his army was expelled. Simultaneously, the Vandals had sacked and captured Carthage in North Africa. Aetius had no choice but to make peace with the Goths in order to deal with the much more important and pressing threat in Africa. Now, this treaty in 439 marked a turning point of enormous importance. Whatever that settlement in 418 had been, it most certainly had not been an agreement between equal partners. It was a dominant group, the Romans, that were dictating the terms. The Treaty of 439, by contrast, was a negotiation between two parties that each had important leverage to exercise. It's not a coincidence that shortly after this, the Visigothic king Theodoric married one of his daughters to the Suevic king Rechiar in Spain, and the other to the son of the Vandal king Gaiseric in Africa. Those are the actions of an independent ruler carrying out his own foreign policy, not the leader of a subordinate army. We might also note that those are the actions of an increasingly confident king, a member of a royal family, looking to buttress his position. As far as we can tell, the Goths were quiet throughout the 440s, though the fact that Aetius' government was fighting the Suaves and Theodoric still married his daughter to the king of the Suaves can't have sat well with Aetius and the central Roman authorities. They next crop up again in 451, when the terrifying Attila the Hun launched his invasion of Gaul. The Visigoths were part of the coalition that met Attila in battle at the Catalaunian Plains, and King Theodoric died on the battlefield after reigning for 32 years, the longest reign of any Visigothic king in this period. Theodoric was replaced by his son Thorismund, who lasted just 2 years before being murdered by his brother, who became king as Theodoric II. This aggressive new king, Theodoric II, found an immediate outlet for his energies, supporting the Gallic aristocrat Avitus in his bid to become emperor after the murder of Valentinian III in 455. For a while, this alliance was successful, and Avitus established himself as the emperor. At this point, the Suaves had established themselves in Mérida in Spain and were in control of almost all of Iberia. They started raiding into Tarraconensis in 456, the last part of the peninsula that was still under the control of the imperial government. To stop them, Avitus dispatched his allied Visigoths from southwestern Gaul, and they tore a swath through the Suaves and sent them packing to the far northwest of the peninsula, where they'd stay for the next 150 years. Avitus didn't last long on the throne, though, and the Visigoths returned to their base of power around Toulouse, abandoning their emperor to his fate. There's some debate among historians as to whether this expedition into Spain in 456, the one that led to the utter defeat of the Suaves, marked the beginning of Visigothic domination of Iberia. Most would say yes, but I'm really not so convinced. Throughout the 460s, Gothic armies had to fight warring bands of Suaves along with the forces of Spanish cities that weren't particularly stoked about giving in to the Goths. I think the historian Michael Kulikovsky gets it right when he talks about these repeated Gothic interventions in the 460s as expeditionary forces rather than an army of occupation. I follow Kulikovsky in thinking that the Goths may have had something like control over Iberia from the 450s on, but they weren't really trying to rule it directly until 507, when they were forced to flee south from Toulouse. Let's leave Spain behind, though. Theodoric II managed to extract Narbonne from the imperial government in return for his military support against the renegade Roman general Aegidius in northern Gaul. In 466 or 467, Theodoric II was in turn murdered by his brother Euric, a scary and competent king who would bring the Visigoths to the peak of their power and might. By the time Yurik came to the throne, the Western Empire was well past its sell-by date and was by any metric crumbling. The Visigoths weren't actively trying to undermine the empire and never really had, though. They were trying to draw the best advantage within the context of that current system. But Yurik, at least for a few years, played that game better than anyone else. When it became clear that the empire was in fact dead and gone, Yurik was happy to extract whatever he could from its ashes. The real turning point there came in 471, when relations between the Gothic and Imperial courts had deteriorated to the point where, for the first time, the two sides would wage open, uncompromising war on one another. The Empire attacked the Goths on two fronts, and were defeated on both. The Goths beat an allied army in central France, and then met and killed the Emperor Anthemius' son in a second battle. Clermont and the Auvergne in central France fell to the Visigoths, and so too did Arles at some point right around there. Yurik died in 484, and was replaced by his son Alaric II, who for a while was the most powerful barbarian ruler of them all, but there was trouble brewing. Frankish raids from the north into Visigothic territory were picking up, and Alaric II was forced to play second fiddle to the Ostrogothic king Theodoric the Great after he took Italy in the 490s. Still, the Visigoths had a powerful and established kingdom, and it was a surprise when they fell in a crushing defeat to the Franks at the Battle of Vouillers in 507. Alaric II was killed in that battle, and the Visigoths were driven from Gaul into Spain, where they would reestablish themselves and hold the peninsula firmly for the next two centuries. 90 years after the settlement around Toulouse, the kingdom came to an end.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So that's the outline of the political history of the Visigothic kingdom from the settlement to its end in Gaul. In this last segment, I want to focus on the people themselves. We'll try to think about all these events from the perspective of a family, to get outside the highest level of politics, to think about society and culture and how the Visigothic kingdom changed internally between the settlement and its destruction in 507. So let's start with a person. We'll call him Gesalic. In 418, he was 30 years old. His father had crossed the Danube with the Goths of 376 and fought at the Battle of Adrianople as a teenager before joining the Roman army following the Treaty of 382. He had married a Roman woman, and Gesalic had been born at a military base in the Balkans. Gesalic's father's commanding officer was Alaric, the general who became a king, and when Alaric rebelled, Gesalic's father went with him. So did Gesalic, who spent his entire childhood on the move as part of this mobile Gothic army. That was the environment in which Gesalic grew up, a military camp. He probably spoke a mixture of Gothic and Latin that was so mixed together as to be more of a Creole than either language altogether. He wore furs and trousers and military belt buckles and brooches. He saw his first battle at the age of 14 in the year 402, fighting against the army of Stilicho at the Battle of Pollentia. Raiding and ravaging would have been second nature to him. At 22, Gesalic participated in the sack of Rome and fought in many more skirmishes and battles in the next 8 years in Italy, Gaul, and Spain before the Visigoths were dispatched to their settlements in and around the city of Toulouse. By this point in 418, Gesalic had risen to become an officer, and he'd married an ex-slave he met during a campaign in Spain, and he had children of his own. By the terms of the settlement, Gesalic would receive tax revenues from the estate of a wealthy Roman aristocrat just outside the city of Toulouse, some of which he'd keep for himself as his pay, and the rest of which he'd send on to the soldiers under his command. For the sake of simplicity, Gesalic and his men, along with their families, would have been billeted on or near that estate. Maybe they would have moved into a deserted village or into some unused outbuildings, or perhaps they would have built new homes of their own on unused land. Either way, this would fit with a settlement predicated on paying the Visigoths with tax shares, but would also account for them having some place to live and for the references to land in the sources. Some of Gesalic's comrades among the Goths were done fighting altogether. His father had survived the journey into Aquitaine, one of the very few left who still remembered life in the old lands beyond the Danube. He was now in his 60s, and he spent the time he had left telling his grandsons and the other young Goths tales of the barbarian lands, of old battles fought against the Vandals, and the glories of the victory at Adrianople. He tried to teach them the Gothic language, though most of them would never fully speak the tongue, just the army Latin spiced with Gothic words that most of them were growing up with, ever more Latin than Gothic now that they were settled among the Romans. Many of those young Goths didn't have a single ancestor who'd crossed the Danube. Their parents or grandparents had been escaped slaves, or Huns, or they'd come from Stilicho's multi-ethnic army, or they'd even been Roman peasants who'd run away from the estates that they belonged to join the Goths. That mattered less, though, than the feeling of shared belonging. Whatever they'd been before, they were Goths now, especially this younger generation, and it was the old hands like Gesalic's father who helped forge a sense of what it meant to claim that identity. This was, first and foremost, a military identity. To be a Goth was to be a soldier, and to be a young Goth, like Gesalic's son, was to be a soldier in training. Gesalic left home only once in the next several years to serve on a campaign in Spain against the Vandals. It wasn't a particularly damaging campaign, or a successful one, but he did return home with some new stories to tell and a bit of plunder to brighten up what was becoming their home. Some of the Goths around Toulouse were starting to put down roots. A few of the nobles were marrying into the lower Roman aristocratic families, and with their pay coming regularly from the rich tax revenues of the region, they had disposable income to spend on farms and estates. Still, this wasn't a permanent settlement, at least not yet. Gesalic fought in a couple more brief campaigns, but nothing too serious. In 426, 8 years after the settlement, the call to arms came again from King Theodoric. This time, though, they were marching toward a Roman city, Arles, rather than toward an enemy army. It was an abortive campaign, just really a show of force, but it was a sign of things to come. Come to think of it, though, the thought of fighting against the Romans didn't really bother Gesalic and his men all that much. They were starting to think of this settled land around Toulouse as theirs, and their allegiance had always been to the king they knew, a general in the field and a sharp operator with their best interests at heart, rather than an effete, decadent Roman emperor they'd never seen. An army of Huns under the Roman general Aetius drove the Goths back toward Toulouse, and this hardened the feelings of Gesalic and his men. They'd lost family and friends to this Roman army. They might still work with the Romans where it was necessary, but this feeling of difference, of otherness, was becoming sharper. Gesalic's children were growing. His oldest son, Frederick, had come of age and would march out with the army the next time they went to war. He had younger daughters, too. One would marry a Goth, another the son of a local Roman landowner. Gesalic had come to know his Roman neighbors. The son of the estate owner from whom they drew their tax revenues had grown up playing with his children and listening to Gesalic's father's stories. That boy cared more for fighting than for reading Roman literature, much to the estate owner's disappointment, and when the Goths went to war again in 436, that Roman boy went with Gesalic, with his son, and with the Gothic army. The Goths attacked Arles and Narbonne, but were driven back to their homes around Toulouse by a Roman army. Gesalic, now nearly 50, was killed by an arrow from a Hunnic archer in the fighting, along with many other Goths. By some miracle, they managed to stave off total defeat, and in the aftermath, they signed a peace treaty with the Romans. Things changed after this, though. Geselik's son Frederik was good friends with the son of the estate owner on whose land they'd long been living, but for many other Goths, those relationships had become strained. Some of these landowners found it easier to simply sell their estates to Gothic nobles, and a few unscrupulous Goths weren't shy about using the threat of force to encourage the sale. Despite this, the overwhelming sense was one of increasing closeness and even assimilation between Goths and Romans, like with Frederik and the son of the estate owner. In the whole of the Visigothic kingdom, there's no material trace of any foreign group. Goths and Romans are archaeologically indistinguishable. They had the same burial practices, wore the same clothes, carried the same weapons, consumed the same goods. Whatever differences might have been apparent to people living at the time, they're not visible in the archaeological record. Frederik had become a talented fighter and had grown close to King Theodoric's son Euric during the recent campaigns. This led to rich rewards for Frederik. He was granted a fine estate close to the one where he'd grown up, and he married the daughter of a mid-level Roman landowner. But it also put him front and center in the conflicts that were constantly breaking out among the Gothic nobles. Some of them wanted to fight the Romans, others wanted to fight the Sueves in Spain, others wanted to go north to fight the Franks, and others were just content to sit in Aquitaine and get rich from the produce of the land. All were willing to fight each other. They were willing to poison each other, and they were willing to assassinate each other. Exile was common among these nobles. Some went to the imperial court to seek service there, others joined the Sueves or the Vandals, others gathered up their own war bands and went to make a name for themselves. By 451, when the army was called out to fight the Huns as part of Aetius's grand coalition, Frederik was 40 years old. He was close to becoming one of the great nobles of the kingdom, with hundreds of soldiers reporting to him. His friend, the son of the Roman landowner, had moved into the orbit of the Visigothic king Theodoric as well. He wasn't the only Roman aristocrat to do so, and the king's court was packed with educated Romans who administered the tax system, kept up the infrastructure, and handled legal issues. A letter of Sidonius Apollinaris from a few years later that describes the court of Theodoric's son and successor as king is full of references to the organized business of governance. For Sidonius Apollinaris, an educated aristocrat, that organized business of governance was obviously carried out along Roman lines. At the same time, more and more of the Goths had turned their pay into land, and land ownership was more and more being seen as the reward for military service rather than pay or tax revenues. The Goths were in the process of becoming a landed military aristocracy, one that was tightly connected to, but at the same time distinct from, the Roman population around it. There was no longer any pretense that the Goths were a Roman army, or that King Theodoric was even subordinate to the emperor. When Aetius had come calling to put his coalition together to fight Attila, that had been a negotiation, not an order. Frederik, unlike many other Goths, was fortunate enough to return from that fight against Attila. The Visigothic kingdom to which he returned was becoming a real independent power block within the empire, one potent enough to flex its muscles by supporting an imperial candidate of its own in the form of Avitus in the year 455. Frederik didn't know Avitus, but his friend, the Roman landowner, had gotten to know him at the Visigothic court. There were few better indicators of how close the Visigoths and the aristocracy of Aquitaine had become than this. Why look to Italy for the center of power when the Visigoths were right there? Avitus's bid for the imperial office didn't last long, but the Visigoths had made themselves known as a power. The star of Frederik's family was rising. His sons, Fritigern and another Geselik, made their names and fortunes during the vicious campaigns in Spain in the late 450s, and his daughters married the sons of Roman aristocrats and other Gothic nobles. Euric, the son of old King Theodoric and Frederik's longtime friend, was on the rise as well. It was with the aid of Frederik and his sons that he murdered King Theodoric II in 466 and became king himself. More campaigns followed, adding the Auvergne and Narbonne, and eventually Arles as well. Frederik's sons picked up lands in these places. They enriched themselves along with all the other Goths. Frederik died an old, accomplished, and powerful man around the year 480. He was nearly 70 years old, and he was of the first generation to spend their lives, or nearly all of them, inside this new Visigothic kingdom. He had lived through its rise and done his part to forge it, as had his father before him. His children now had children of their own. It was his grandsons who would fight and perhaps die at the Battle of Huillay in 507 against the Franks, and who would go on to make their lives and futures in Spain for the next two centuries. It's a mistake, one we call teleology, to read back from an endpoint and use that as our lens, our frame, to decide what things mattered and what we're going to focus on. To do that misses the whole point of what makes the Visigothic kingdom interesting. It was the actions of people like Gesalic and Frederic and their daughters and sons and their Roman friends that forged the Visigothic kingdom. It wasn't destined to become a powerful kingdom or to have a long life in Spain after its expulsion from Gaul. It was a process of becoming that made the Visigothic kingdom what it was, a long journey that took a wandering, down-on-its-luck army and built a people and a state. Next time, we'll talk about the other Goths, the Ostrogoths, and the kingdom they built in Italy. Theirs was a surprisingly Roman kingdom, Roman enough that an observer wouldn't have been faulted for confusing their king with the emperor himself. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat a bit about the fall of the Roman Empire, you can always drop me a line. If you want to help me out even a bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.